In this talk, we shall be considering not the historic origins and literary sources of Henry IV, Part One, nor indeed the technicalities of Shakespearean scholarship, but the interpretation of the play in dramatic and practical terms. It's very tempting when studying Henry IV to dwell on the popular and eye-catching figures of Prince Hal and Falstaff and Henry Hotspur. Each of these characters is, of course, immensely important to the play, for Shakespeare never includes a character in a play without a very good reason. Nevertheless, the play is not called The Comical History of Prince Hal and the Fat Knight. It's called The First Part of King Henry IV, and William Shakespeare was too good a dramatist and too great a master of words to mistitle his play. Agreed, the part of the king is not very big in terms of lines, and the star actors, therefore, tend to play the more showy parts of Prince Hal, Falstaff, and Hotspur. In this way, the king as a figure tends to be rather overshadowed. But when the structure of the play is examined, it's clearly seen that the king is the central axis of the story. If we remove the king, the play falls apart. One has to remember that Henry IV, Part One, is one of a series of historical plays all concerned with the idea and function of monarchy and monarchical government. Each of Shakespeare's kings shows a different aspect of leadership and power and the problems. Henry IV, for instance, shows the struggle to establish and legitimize his occupation of the throne which he had wrested from Richard II. Shakespeare displays very clearly the superb leadership, the knowledge of psychology, and the sense of occasion which enabled Henry to overcome the clumsy and inept Richard. In Act 3, Scene 2, for instance, the speech in which King Henry advises his prodigal son, the Prince of Wales, how to gain the respect and awe of his subjects is a masterly exercise in political, psychological tactics. He starts off by lamenting that his son is a byword for his riotous behavior, and familiar to the eyes of common men, whilst a stranger to court. And then he goes on.
Had I so lavish of my presence been, so common hackneyed in the eyes of men, so stale and cheap to vulgar company, opinion that did help me to the crown had still kept loyal to possession, and left me in reputeless banishment, a fellow of no mark nor likelihood. By being seldom seen, I could not stir, but like a comet I was wondered at, that men would tell their children, this is he. Others would say, where, which is Bolingbroke? And then I stole all courtesy from heaven, and dressed myself in such humility that I did pluck allegiance from men's hearts, loud shouts and salutations from their mouths, even in the presence of the crowned king. Thus did I keep my person fresh and new, my presence like a robe pontifical, ne'er seen but wondered at. And so my state, seldom but sumptuous, showed like a feast, and won by rareness such solemnity. The skipping king, he ambled up and down with shallow jesters and rash babbin wits, soon kindled and soon burnt, carded his state, mingled his royalty with capering fools, had his great name profaned with their scorns, and gave his countenance against his name to laugh at jibing boys and stand the push of every beardless vain comparative, grew a companion to the common streets, enfiefed himself to popularity, that being daily swallowed by men's eyes, they surfeited with honey and began to loathe the taste of sweetness, whereof a little more than a little is by much too much. Soon when he had occasion to be seen, he was but as the cuckoo is in June, heard, not regarded, seen, but with such eyes as sick and blunted with community, afford no extraordinary gaze, such as is bent on sun-like majesty when it shines seldom in admiring eyes, but rather drowsed and hung their eyelids down, slept in his face, and rendered such aspect as cloudy men use to their adversaries, being with his presence glutted, gorged, and full. And in that very line, Harry, standest thou. For thou hast lost thy princely privilege with vile participation. Not an eye, but is a weary of thy common sight. Save mine, which hath desired to see thee more. What better explanation could one have of the deliberate creation of a public demand? Here is the most sought-after figure in the land, the monarch, consciously rationing his appearances so as to ensure that mystical apartness which is an element of his power over men's minds and hearts. In this speech, the bard is expounding one of the basic demands of leadership, the necessary loneliness of the leader, of the captain on his ship, the judge on his bench, the managing director behind his desk. Note that Henry is not advocating the haughty sense of apartness and superiority, which would alienate the affections of his people. When he does appear, there is already a tremendous interest, an expectancy in this seldom seen figure. Every eye devours his royal magnificence. Every man is awed by the richness and power of his office. And yet, in the midst of all the panoply, the people see a man dressed in humility and courteous, even to his meanest subject. Look at that as the instinctive response. All that power and glory, yet he takes the trouble to stop and have a word with us poor folk. He's a good man. He is, in fact, a better man than they take him for, because he has mastered the concept of noblesse oblige. Henry has learned, among other things, the lesson of King Richard's unpopularity with the people. It stems from overexposure. And it's a lesson which is still as valid today, as the Queen showed when, for instance, she cancelled her last Christmas broadcast, because the royal family had been seen enough in one year. Overexposure in our own day is much more easy through the medium of TV and modern communications. And it's still a fundamental lesson the potential leader must learn. On the other hand, the King, who is so humble with his people, must conduct himself very differently with his proud, rebellious nobles of Northumberland and Lord Worcester. There's no humility in his words to Worcester in Act 1, Scene 3. He speaks as the fountain of authority in his realm. As a watchful leader, he's perfectly well aware of Worcester's attempts to stir up rebellion against him. And the King says, "My blood hath been too cold and temperate, unapt to stir at these indignities. And you have found me, for accordingly you tread upon my patience. But be sure, I will from henceforth rather be myself, mighty and to be feared, than my condition, which hath been smooth as oil, soft as young down, and therefore lost that title of respect which the proud soul ne'er pays but to the proud." The King is talking there to his near equal, a man whose immense power helped him, the King, to the throne. Smooth talk and placatory gestures mean very little to Northumberland, for instance, whose vast power in the north rests on the strength of his arm and the sharpness of his sword. In the ways of power, much wants more. The appetite for power grows with what it feeds on. And Northumberland and his allies want the rewards of their support of the former Bolingbroke against King Richard. Greed for gain, together with the dangerous taste of king-making, makes a very heady drink. It intoxicates and impairs the judgment. Henry knows that these powerful men, Northumberland and Worcester, cannot be handled with kid gloves. Through trying to conciliate them, being as smooth as oil, he has lost that title of respect which the proud soul ne'er pays but to the proud. He has to confront them with naked power and all the open authority of his office. There is another aspect of the problem of authority. It's the problem of the politician of today as well, of course.
When seeking office, it's customary to promise a betterment of the people's lives in various ways. But when he has gained office on the strength of those election promises, the new leader often finds that the demands of the total situation make it impossible to carry out his reforms in the way intended. He was speaking before the election as a party politician. Now he is speaking as a national leader. There is a difference. Many a politician has promised things which, from his pre-election position, seemed attainable and logical. But with the wider responsibility and the overall knowledge of office, he's been forced to reconceive the position. So with King Henry. He has different responsibilities now. His job is to see that, as he says in the opening speech of the play, those opposed eyes, which, like the meteors of a troubled heaven, all of one nature, of one substance bred, did lately meet in the intestine shock and furious close of civil butchery, shall now, in mutual, well-beseeming ranks, march all one way, and be no more opposed against acquaintance, kindred, and allies. He's saying, in effect, the throne is the center of balance in which all oppositions meet. These statements on the uses and responsibilities of kingly power are as true today as ever they were. In Shakespeare's own day, the writers and the formers of public opinion were intensely concerned with the theory of government, and not only government of the nation, but the internal government of the individual human being. The ferment of ideas, which was the chief characteristic of the Renaissance, were all concerned with man, his origin, his development, his place in society, and so on. The ideas which came from the European Renaissance were eagerly taken up by the Elizabethans. The educated men of the day discussed works on politics, power, and government by Francis Bacon, Machiavelli, and others. One of the more important aspects of this Renaissance was the preoccupation with the real nature of order, with the formulation of possible systems by which the universe might be run, with the inherent laws of nature and art, and with ideal orders of government. Shakespeare was no exception to the mainstream of his day's thought. Time and again, he discusses in the plays these problems of order, system, and authority, both inside man as an individual and outside man in his relation with other men and with nature. Henry Bolingbroke, young, confident, and immensely capable, deposed Richard II and succeeded him because he was the better man for the job. What he learns in the intervening years is the price any leader has to pay for power, his disillusion as former allies and kinsmen plot against him, his anguish as his son and heir, the Prince of Wales, apparently fritters away his life in the riotous living which is made possible for him by his rank. These are part of the price of kingship. The monarch is the supreme power and ruler. To preserve that rule, he must create a stable and ordered state. And in doing so, he's bound to make enemies of those who do not like the discipline imposed upon them, and those who are unwilling to subordinate their own power to the universal order of the king. Eventually, in fact, Henry IV handed on to his son a stable and wealthy kingdom, but the weight and responsibility of the crown of England wore out the man in the process. As Prince Hal says in the soliloquy on the crown in part two of Henry IV, "O polished perturbation, golden care, that keeps the ports of slumber open wide to many a watchful night." The rebellious elements which threaten law and order in the state are clear. In this play, from below, there are men like Falstaff, Pistol, Bardolph, Nym, and Poins, who want a good time and who care very little for the structure of society. They cannot control themselves, or will not control themselves, so laws must be formulated to control them from outside. The self-indulgent few cannot be allowed to endanger the good order of the whole state. The king's justice maintains that order, from which even the king's son is not immune, he too must obey the general law. Thus, Falstaff and his merry crew are the representatives of the self-indulgent lower orders, men without self-control. But a very different threat to the stability of society is presented by the aristocracy. Northumberland, Worcester and co. are men eager not for pleasure, but for power. Against them, the king must employ the ultimate weapon, sheer force. The nobles considered in their day that the law was made to control the lower classes and didn't apply to themselves. Power has no respect for law. It can only be crushed by superior power. They know that behind all law lies power to keep the law in being. So two types of danger threaten the state: the pleasure seekers and the power seekers. For the good order of the state, both must be subdued. There was indeed a parallel to this play in the state of England at the time when this play was first presented. The unity and peace of the country was endangered by powerful factions who sought to gain the upper hand, and the increasing prosperity of England in that day led inevitably to a stress on pleasure and high living. The rapidly changing conditions of life were stretching the social fabric to breaking point. The cause of order needed a champion. And, in his way, Shakespeare chose to be that man. But not in any petty sense. His characters aren't hollow loudspeakers for the author's opinions. They're richly complex human beings with all the contradictions of humanity. Falstaff lived for and in his fat belly, but he was also fed by a rich vein of humor. Indeed, in his parody of King Henry in the inn scene, he uses very much the same arguments against Hal's conduct as did the king himself. Or again, Hotspur may be a rash, uncultured, uncontrollable young rebel, but he's also a brave, honorable, and skillful soldier. One of the gravest threats to an ordered kingdom is a weak heir to the throne, and throughout the play, King Henry is uneasy about his son, the Prince of Wales. From his own experience of Richard II, he knows how bad government breeds disorder in the country. In the confrontation with Prince Hal, in Act 3, Scene 2, the king voices his misgivings to his son.
I know not whether God will have it so for some displeasing service I have done, that in his secret doom out of my blood he'll bleed revengement and a scourge for me. But thou dost in thy passages of life make me believe that thou art only marked for the hot vengeance and the rod of heaven to punish my mistreadings.
And again, later on in the same scene, he says,
Yet let me wonder, Harry, at thy affections, which do hold a wing quite from the flight of all thy ancestors. Thy place in council thou hast rudely lost, which by thy younger brother is supplied, and art almost an alien to the hearts of all the court and princes of my blood. The hope and expectation of thy time is ruined, and the soul of every man prophetically doth forethink thy fall.
But, of course, the king need not be worried, for Hal has already revealed to us, the audience, the true reason for all his apparent misdoings. In Act 1, Scene 2, looking after his departed companions of Cheapside, he says,
I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humor of your idleness. Yet herein will I imitate the sun, who doth permit the base, contagious clouds to smother up his beauty from the world, that when he please again to be himself, being wanted, he may be more wondered at, by breaking through the foul and ugly mists of vapors that did seem to strangle him. If all the year were playing holidays, to sport would be as tedious as to work. But when they seldom come, they wished for come, and nothing pleaseth but rare accidents. So, when this loose behavior I throw off and pay the debt I never promised, by how much better than my word I am, by so much shall I falsify men's hopes, and like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men least think I will.
Cold-blooded? Calculating? Well, perhaps. And it certainly ties up with his later ruthlessness when he attains the throne and throws off Falstaff. But remember, this young man is the heir of England. He has much to learn. And one of the most important lessons is the one which lays bare the springs of human action. He has been born into noble society, and he knows their psychology, their traditions. Now, he is consciously learning about the ordinary people of the land whom he will one day govern. And he's learning about them firsthand. He's a prodigal son, yes, but a deliberate one. His later understanding of his soldiers, his infallible hold on their affections, that little touch of Harry in the night before Agincourt, all these were born out of the understanding gained in the taverns of Cheapside. The necessities of law he has learned out of the escapade at Gad's Hill. On top of this invaluable experience, he is playing for the added bonus of public relief and applause when this seemingly wild young profligate suddenly turns out to be a bright jewel in the crown. The experience of life which he is now digesting will impress his own aristocratic kind, and his wild oats will endear him to the populace. He becomes human to them. Shakespeare was very well aware that the essence of drama, indeed the essence of life itself, is conflict, opposition. Opposition creates interest, awareness. Order opposes disorder, the king opposes his nobles, and so on. Prince Henry's opposite is another Henry, Henry Percy, called Hotspur. Hotspur, as his name suggests, is the quick-tempered, rash, ill-schooled, ill-mannered, powerful young nobleman who is held up to Hal as an example. In many ways, he's a sort of opposite twin to the prince. This romantic figure from the wild north has proved his manhood continuously in battle against Scots raiders into Percy's Northumberland territories. Prowess with the sword was the accepted proof of manhood in his day, and the proud young knight is a very popular figure. But the argument of the history is order versus disorder, and Hotspur, by that rule, is not the stuff of which kings and orderers are made. Hotspur is not even king of himself, and is constantly reproved, even by his own side. When the king, for instance, demands Percy's prisoners in Act 1, Scene 3, the young man bursts out, "And if the devil come and roar for them, I will not send them. I will have to straighten tell him so, for I will ease my heart, albeit I make a hazard of my head." Now, good government demands that the head should rule the heart, not the other way about. It's a little short-sighted to ease your emotions at the cost of losing your head and all. Hotspur gets more and more excited until he's completely beyond control of either his father, Northumberland, or his uncle, Worcester. And Worcester eventually says, "Good cousin, give me audience for a while."
"Oh, I cry you mercy."
"Those same noble Scots that are your prisoners..."
"I'll keep them all. By God, he shall not have a Scot of them. No, if a Scot would save his soul, he shall not. I'll keep them by this hand."
"You start away and lend no ear unto my purposes. Those prisoners you shall keep."
"I will, that's flat. He said he would not ransom Mortimer, forbade my tongue to speak of Mortimer. But I will find him when he lies asleep, and in his ear I'll holla, Mortimer. Nay, I'll have a starling shall be taught to speak nothing but Mortimer, and give it to him, to keep his anger still in motion."
"Hear you, cousin, a word.
All studies here I solemnly defy, save how to gall and pinch this Bolingbroke. And that same sword and buckler, Prince of Wales, but that I think his father loves him not, and would be glad he met with some mischance, I'd have him poisoned with a pot of ale."
"Farewell, kinsman. I'll talk to you when you are better tempered to attend." Hotspur loses his head so often, in fact, throughout the play, that he endangers the cause of his own side. Diplomacy is essential in politics,
And Hotspur shows his lack of it by tactlessly opposing the mystical Glendower, Owen Glendower, about his origin and powers. In Act 3, Scene 1, as Owen Glendower traces his auspicious birth and boasts of his magical arts, Hotspur becomes ruder and ruder.
I am not in the role of common men. Where is he living, Clifton, with the sea that tides the banks of England, Scotland, Wales, which calls me pupil or hath read to me? And bring him out that is but woman's son, can trace me in the tedious ways of art, and hold me pace in deep experiments.
I think there's no man speaks better Welsh out at dinner.
Peace, cousin Percy, you'll make him mad. I can call spirits from the vasty deep.
Why, so can I, or so can any man. But will they come when you do call for them?
Why, I can teach you, cousin, to command the devil.
And I can teach thee, cuss, to shame the devil by telling truth. Tell truth and shame the devil.
If thou have power to raise him, bring him hither, and I'll be sworn I have power to shame him hence. Oh, while you live, tell truth and shame the devil.
Come, come. No more of this unprofitable chat.
3 times of Henry Bolingbroke made head against my power. 3 from the banks of Wye and Sandy Bottom 7 have I sent him, bootless home and weather-beaten back.
Home without boots, and in foul weather too. How scapes he agues in the devil's name? But immediately after this, the rebels reveal their irresponsibility and greed for their own gain when they propose to divide the kingdom into 3 parts between them. And incidentally, Hotspur even quarrels over that. England at that time was only just escaping from the disunity and the land quarrels of earlier centuries, and had just begun to be a united kingdom. Now the rebels talk of plunging the whole country back again into turmoil. But to get back to Hotspur. His uncle Worcester, after the Glendower episode, charges Hotspur with defect of manners, with want of government, with pride, haughtiness, opinion and disdain. Hare-brained Hotspur, governed by a spleen. Again his uncle's words. Is not a match for the wily strategy and the skill in statecraft of the king. Nor indeed is he a match even for the crafty intrigues of his own uncle Worcester, who later on conceals from Hotspur the king's offer of a pardon in case Hotspur's generous nature should accept it and spoil Worcester's power plotting. Now, Henry, Prince of Wales, is a very different breed from Henry Hotspur. Here we have an apparently frivolous man-about-town who conceals under his light exterior a cool and calculating brain. He has a deliberate purpose in all that he does, and in all his excesses, he never loses sight of his ultimate destiny, the throne of England. Hal is a realist. Hotspur is a romantic. Hotspur is a good soldier, but Hal is a good general. It's logical that in the plot, Hal should beat Hotspur. The meeting of these 2 so different men is inevitable. As Hal says, when they come upon each other at the Battle of Shrewsbury, I am the Prince of Wales, and think not Percy to share with me in glory any more. 2 stars keep not their motion in 1 sphere, nor can England brook a double reign of Harry, Percy, and the Prince of Wales. And so it proves, of course. Hotspur is killed, and dies lamenting the proud titles of honour he has lost to the Prince by his defeat. Titles that he values more than life itself. Had Hotspur won the fight, or if he had truly been the changeling son the king wishes in 1 speech that he were, he would still have proved a bad king. Those who would have control over others must first gain control over themselves, and Henry Percy never learned self-control, as his nickname tells us. But nevertheless, our sympathy is very much with Hotspur. His faults are those of a generous nature, and he is the soul of honour. We've seen that the Percys of Northumberland are fairly simple in their motives. They have enormous, though ill-disciplined, power in their northern fastnesses, and they're seldom troubled by the faraway court in London. They hold their lands by the sword, and their way of life is that of the soldier. But the Earl of Worcester is a different kind of Percy. He's the intriguer, the professional stirrer-up of trouble,
Cold, proud, and ambitious, he's a constant danger to established authority. Westmoreland says of him that he is malevolent to the king in all respects, which makes him prune himself and bristle up the crest of youth against the king's dignity. In other words, Worcester keeps his own perfidy quiet and lets others, like young Hotspur, bear the main responsibility of open rebellion, or at least at first. Worcester shows his cold arrogance to the king in Act 1, Scene 3. Our house, my sovereign liege, little deserves the scourge of greatness to be used on it, and that same greatness to which our own hands have hoped to make so portly. But Worcester's gone too far, and he earns the king's royal rebuke. Worcester, get thee gone, or I do see danger and disobedience in thine eye. Oh, sir, your presence is too bold and peremptory, and majesty might never yet endure the moody frontier of a servant brow. You have good leave to leave us. When we need your use and counsel, we shall send for you. In every major speech of Worcester's, you will read a mind so tortuous in its workings, so used to intrigue and plotting, that it cannot see a simple answer, but always interprets everything in the most devious way. He hardly ever has good to say of anybody. He is, in fact, the personification of the devil as adversary. By his own admission in Act 5, Scene 1, Worcester was an office-bearer under Richard II, and treacherously betrayed him to kiss Bolingbroke's hand. How then could that same Bolingbroke, now Henry IV, be sure that Worcester would not repeat his treachery? Yet even when the king, in his effort to bring unity again to the land, offers to pardon all the rebels and be their friend if they will yield, even then Worcester is treacherous. In the following scene, Worcester persuades Vernon that Hotspur must not hear of the king's offer in case he accepts it. Worcester once again presents a devious and plausible argument why Hotspur should not be told, but we know enough of his character to be quite sure that the real reason was that Worcester didn't relish having the rebellion ruined by what he admits is the king's kind and generous offer. There can be very little sympathy for him, therefore, when after the battle he's led to execution at the king's order. The other major conspirator against the sovereign is Owen Glendower of Wales. This strange, dark man, full of conceits and bombastic utterances of his own importance and magical powers, fails to turn up at the Battle of Shrewsbury. He is the symbol of unreliability, the type of man who promises much and performs little. There's usually one such weak link in the chain of conspiracy. One of the most humorous scenes in the play is when Glendower is boasting of his birth and his exploits, and the down-to-earth Hotspur pooh-poohs such vanity. The power plot, if we may so call it, is the main theme of the play, of course. But running along with it, there is always a subplot, and in Henry IV, Part 1, we have the glorious comedy scenes in which that immortal character, Falstaff, is the chief character, surrounded by his satellites in disorder. The subplot is a topsy-turvy equivalent of the main plot, where Falstaff is substituted for the king, and the disordered factions in court are paralleled by the disordered factions of the tavern and Gad's Hill. We find the most obvious example of this when Falstaff becomes king in an imaginary interview with his son in the inn scene. The subplot is in fact a kind of counterpoint to the main theme, and in performance it's sometimes allowed, alas, to overshadow it. Shakespeare never intended it to do so, but he was aware that humour is the means whereby the audience can relax at intervals from the serious business of the rest of the play. But any statement one makes about Shakespeare must be tempered by the obvious fact that he never has only one reason for doing something. His invention is so rich that it spills over into a dozen different reasons for one scene. Falstaff stands valid in himself as one of the greatest comic characters ever brought forth in any literature. Falstaff is real, alive, and totally convincing, despite his grotesque appearance.
The Fat Knight, or as Prince Hal calls him in Act 2, Scene 4, that trunk of humours, that bolting hutch of beastliness, that swollen parcel of dropsies, that huge bombard of sack, that stuffed cloak bag of guts, that roast manning tree ox with the pudding in his belly, that reverend vice, that grey iniquity, that father ruffian, that vanity in years, that Falstaff, is the very essence of the man who's given himself over entirely to the pleasures of the flesh. He sums up in one man all the qualities which are part of the life of appetite. His vast consumption of food and liquor, his total lack of moral scruples when they would interfere with his desires for pleasure, his cowardice, which stems from fear of pain, the opposite of pleasure, and his idleness. All these are disgraceful and disgusting in themselves, and yet, by some magic, audiences love the old man. Perhaps it's because Shakespeare has endowed him with all the genial good humour of his type, and the wit born of a mind which has grown swift in excuses and the soft answer that turns away the wrath of those he's cheated. Hear the practiced ease with which he uses specious words and twisted arguments to get himself out of a tight spot, and how he can change his horse in midstream. When Hal has played the celebrated trick on Falstaff at Gad's Hill, and stolen from him the money he had just stolen from the travellers, they meet again, you may remember, at the Boar's Head. Falstaff, unaware of the true identity of his attackers, is calling the Prince and Poins cowards because they didn't turn up, and swaggering about as a brave hero himself. Little does he know, of course, that they were there all the time, and they in fact stole the money from him.
"And now, Woolsack, what matter you?"
"King's son, if I do not beat thee out of thy kingdom with a dagger of laugh, and drive all thy subjects before thee like a flock of wild geese, I'll never wear hair on my face more. Oh, you, Prince of Wales."
"Why, you horse and round man, what's the matter?"
"Are you not a coward? Answer me that, and Poins there."
"Soldier, fat paunchard, you call me coward, by the Lord, I'll stab you."
I call thee coward? I said it, damned, or I'll call thee coward. Oh, but I'd give £1,000 I could run as fast as thou canst."
In the same scene, after much boasting, Falstaff is exposed by the prince. When he reveals the fat man's cowardice, and that he himself and Poins were the cause of him being relieved of his stolen money at Gad's Hill. But he's not a whit disturbed. Falstaff lies his way out of trouble to the manor born. When all has been revealed, the prince says to Falstaff,
"Come, let's hear, Jack. What trick hast thou now?"
"By the Lord, I knew ye as well as he that made ye. Why, hear ye, my masters. Was it for me to kill the heir apparent? Should I turn upon the true prince? Why, thou knowest I'm as valiant as Hercules. But beware, instinct. The lion will not touch the true prince. Instinct is a great matter. I was now a coward on instinct. I shall think the better of myself and thee during my life. I for a valiant lion, and thou for a true prince. Oh, but be the Lord, lads, I'm glad you have the money. Upstairs, clap the doors, watch tonight, pray tomorrow. Gallants, lads, boys, hearts of gold, all the titles of good fellowship come to you. What shall we be merry?"
Above all, the fat rogue has a goodly store of worldly wisdom, learned in the thieves' kitchens and the shady taverns in which he spends his life. But perhaps what we admire most about Falstaff is his talent for survival in the trickiest spot, and his ability to turn it profitably to his own account. Henry the Fourth, Part One, is the history of the age-old struggle between the forces of order and the forces of chaos. In the end, of course, Henry the Fourth wins,
and establishes the order which his son will inherit as the fifth of that line. Incidentally, at the end of the day, when Hotspur is dead and Worcester is executed, Henry exercises another and very important prerogative of power, mercy. He pardons the wild and brave Douglas, who, from being the enemy of the Percys, had become their ally against the old enemy, the king, the central power. So Douglas goes free to his mountain haunts of Scotland, and the old king, with his two sons, girds himself for a further struggle against Henry Hotspur's father, Northumberland, and the other foes of his order and unity. In this way, Shakespeare tells us that government is continuous, an inheritance, passing down a line of kings, and continuously having to meet the shocks and furies of those forces which would destroy all law, all harmony, all unity, and reduce all to the chaos out of which man has so painfully dragged himself. As the king says at the end of the play, "Rebellion in this land shall lose his sway, meeting the check of such another day. And since this business so fair is done, let us not leave till all our own be won." Three talks on Shakespearean themes. The first is called The Fool in Shakespeare. The fool in Shakespearean drama is a complex and mysterious figure. His speech is a mercurial composition of opposites. He is by turns lucid and obscure, inconsequential and deeply significant, gay and sad. The listener is at once arrested and bewildered by his variety of utterance. Although Shakespeare's fools are linked by their common function, they have separate and distinctive characters. There's little in common between the personalities of Touchstone in As You Like It and the fool in Lear, or between Lavache in All's Well That Ends Well and Costard in Love's Labour's Lost. Whenever the fool appears, he turns upside down the apparent social order of society and holds its usages to ridicule. He presents to man a mocking image of his own pretensions, and in the households of the great, which are his usual habitat, there's no lack of material for his wit. The great man is seldom honestly served or addressed, for the sycophants who surround him feed his vanity, but never openly obstruct or criticize his will. Historically, the licensed fool repaired this omission in the household. As the fool says to Lear, "That sir which serves and seeks for gain, and follows but for form, will pack when it begins to rain, and leave thee in the storm. But I will tarry, the fool will stay, and let the wise man fly. The knave turns fool that runs away, the fool no knave perdee." The job of the licensed fool wasn't merely to rescue his master from the melancholy sometimes attendant on the burden of power, but also to speak his mind freely on all subjects and to all persons, without fear or favour. His only tool was his humorous wit, which both pointed his remarks and at the same time made them more assimilable to the hearer. In As You Like It, when Jakes becomes enamoured of the fool's calling, he describes the conditions of employment for a fool like this. "I must have liberty, with all as large a charter as the wind to blow on whom I please, for so fools have, and they that are most galled with my folly, they most must laugh. And wiser must they so. The why is plain as way to parish church. He that a fool doth very wisely hit, doth very foolishly, although he smart, not to seem senseless of the bob. If not, the wise man's folly is anatomized even by the squandering glances of the fool." No man in the household, no woman neither, was safe from the wit and the shafts of the jester, and woe betide that one who did not accept its barb with a smile. To be incapable of bearing criticism is always a grave lack, but especially so in those about the man of affairs. When attacked by the fool, the arrogant, the weak, and the villainous character in Shakespeare always react badly and so reveal their motives for what they are. For instance, Malvolio's reaction to Touchstone's wit is a typical reaction.
I marvel your ladyship takes delight in such a barren rascal. I saw him put down the other day with an ordinary fool that has no more brain than a stone. I protest, I take these wise men that crow so at these set kind of fools no better than the fool zanies.
To which his mistress shrewdly observes, Oh, you are sick of self-love, Malvolio, and taste with a distempered appetite. To be generous, guiltless, and of free disposition is to take those things for bird bolts that you deem cannon bullets. By contrast, the honest and the wise are amused and touched by the real wisdom of the fool. As the Duke says of Touchstone, for instance, he uses his folly like a stalking horse, and under the presentation of that he shoots his wit. And Jakes, in the same scene, says, Is this not a rare fellow, my lord? He's good at anything, and yet a fool. Here is an acknowledgement that the deliberate fool has chosen to be so as a vocation. It's more than a profession. And the requirements of the calling make him a rare fellow. He has to be quick-witted and a master of words, beholden to no man, honest and uncaring of this world's goods, a psychologist, and able to see humor even in death. Consider what Viola, in As You Like It, says of the fool's qualities. This fellow's wise enough to play the fool, and to do that well craves a kind of wit. He must observe their mood on whom he jests, the quality of persons and the time, and, like the haggard, check at every feather that comes before his eye. This is a practice as full of labor as a wise man's art, for folly that he wisely shows is fit, but wise men, folly fawn, quite taint their wit. In that last line, Wise men, folly fallen, Shakespeare's perhaps hinting that all men are wise in the spirit until their folly makes them mortal and they fall like Adam from grace into time. The cloud-capped towers and gorgeous palaces of this world are then an unreality, a folly. In the same way, those strange structures which dot our countryside are called follies. They are fantastical monuments to the foolish presumption of their builders. It's part of the paradoxical nature of this world that man has one foot in time and one in eternity. Shakespeare often mentions it, and his fools are aware of the contradiction, and they embody it. For the fool is both shrewd in the ways of this world and innocent of their effects. He's as wayward as the spirit and opposite in everything. In one aspect, he is the relentless critic of man's worldly folly, and in another, his simplicity itself, a very child of the spirit. The Fool in King Lear is a case in point. His speeches are full of the contradictions that we've been looking at. Light and dark alternate in him in bewildering succession. Like all fools, he's as close to his master as conscience, of which, in some degree, he is the actual symbol. Indeed, when his reason fails, Lear's discourse carries echoes of the fool. The fool and the madman mingle eternal truths with timely observations. They seem to have access to a sphere of simultaneous wisdom which is denied to the prosaic man. In that bright world they live in, each idea is infolded with every other, and they tumble into expression pell-mell. The hearer divines their meaning better than the reason can explain. And because the action of the plays takes place on many more than the merely physical level, we may see the disappearance of the fool when Lear goes mad as meaning that Lear has become his own fool. As his worldly follies are exposed and recognized, the old king retreats from rationality into the simplicity of his foolish soul. There's much to be said for this image of the fool as the soul of man. The picture of the fool in the traditional tarot pack of cards is a very ancient rendering of this theory. In Motley, and accompanied only by his dog of faith, he travels blithely on his life's way over the edge of the cliff into the pit. Innocent and without care, he's able to survive in a world where care brings only care. So far, we've talked mainly about the deliberate fool, but we have to distinguish between him and the natural fool. The simpleton has been tolerated in many societies because it was supposed that he had been touched by a divine hand. Yet his childlike concern with his own body and its needs and appetites and their expression horrified the more conditioned elders. The natural fool has not yet gained the mental and psychological sophistication which veil and constrict natural expression. The innocent preoccupation with basic processes offends against the social conformism and the morality which are at once the security and the prison of their subjects. The conscious fool has still his natural fool, his simpleton, within, and it's by no means stifled. All the fools in Shakespeare are very free with their allusions to the basic facts of human life. But his innocence looks through his eye and sees the polity by which men veil their natural appetites from each other and even from themselves. And like the child, the fool is embarrassingly frank about what he sees. His innocence is not bound by custom, by conformity. The fool is really a licensed revolutionary. Whatever is posited, he negates. What stands firmly on its feet in this world, he turns precariously on its head. He makes sense of nonsense and nonsense of sense. He is the witness of a creation which, paradoxically, subsists as a unity only by the diverse opposition of its parts. Once let the fool in with his simple eye and handy-dandy, which is the justice, which is the thief. Lear's fool makes a prophecy as illustration of this upside-down world of folly. When priests are more in word than matter, when brewers mar their malt with water, when nobles are their tailors' tutors, no heretics burned but wenches suitors, when every case in law is right, no squire in debt nor no poor knight, when slanders do not live in tongues, nor cut purses come not to throngs, when usurers tell their gold i' the field, and bawds and whores do churches build, then shall the realm of Albion come to great confusion. Which is as much as to say that this mad world, this fabric of folly, is built on lies, cheating, and corruption, which only fools can see with the eyes of innocence. The confusing words of the fool are no bad thing when they help man to unravel the ludicrous twistings of the darkened world and jostle him into the light where, as Hamlet's uncle puts it, there is no shuffling, there the action lies in its true nature. In the second part of King Henry IV, a character called Lord Say, who by so saying is a true fool, says, "The trust I have is in my innocence, and therefore am I bold and resolute." It's the innocence of the fool which enables him to make the beau geste that saves a sad world with a joke. Man, the microcosm. William Shakespeare may be said to sum up in one individual the whole glory of the English literary Renaissance. In one sense, at least, this would have been an acceptable idea to his contemporaries, for the Elizabethan mind was familiar with the concept of man as the microcosm of a macrocosm. Man, that is, as containing in his individual being all the qualities and functions of the great sphere of creation. The bard is quoting the tradition passed on from the Middle Ages when he refers to man as being a little kingdom, which exactly mirrors the political kingdom of which he is a part. According to medieval thinkers, the universe was a vast sphere of hierarchical or ordered function. Every part of that universe had its proper place and purpose in relation to all other parts, and all in obedience to the grand purpose of the whole creation. Obedience by each part to the laws governing the whole was vital to the well-being of the whole. Rebellion by any one part or group of parts brought disharmony and dis-ease to the whole being. Shakespeare puts into the mouth of that cunning character Ulysses a very great speech about the heavenly order in Act 1, Scene 3 of Troilus and Cressida. The sun is said to be, in that speech, the sovereign will and ordering intelligence of the solar system, the creator's function made manifest in the physical world. The solar will keeps the planetary forces in their proper orbits. If the planets fail in their obedience to the good of the harmonic whole of the solar system, then the outcome is disaster and the breakdown of the hierarchy of powers. When the planets in evil mixture to disorder wander, what plagues and what portents, what mutiny, what raging of the sea, shaking of earth, commotions in the winds, frights, changes, horrors, divert and crack, rend and deracinate the unity and married calm of states quite from their fixture. This grand structure of degree was pictured in several ways, as a ladder, for instance, with its different rungs or levels, or as a series of concentric circles emanating from a central will or authority. Each level, rung, or circle partakes of the nature of the whole because it is an expression of the creative will which originates the whole. Thus, the nation-state obeys the same law as does the solar system. The central sovereign power is orbited by a close group of counselors. Beyond them circulate the officers of the law. Then comes the administrative body, the army, and finally the citizens. Each moves in its proper orbit round the central authority, and all depends on mutual respect for the good of the whole. As Exeter says in the opening scene of King Henry V, "For government, though high and low and lower, put into parts, doth keep in one consent, congreeing in a full and natural close, like music." Shakespeare never leaves us with only one illustration of an important concept. He is familiar with the Pythagorean system of the heavenly spheres, each having its own musical tone, which, in harmonic conjunction, make up the grand chord of creation. Now he applies it to the nation-state and the harmonic interplay of its separate institutions. Because man is the image in little of the great universe and of all its precipitated levels, then the institutions of the state find their echo in the individual being within the state. The will in man is the counterpart of the king. The faculty of reason is an individual council of state. The digestive system is the equivalent of the food distribution in the state, and so on. In this ancient concept of man as microcosm, each sub-entity within him has a form, a function, and a substantial reality. It is, then, a being within a hierarchical system. Menenius in Coriolanus illustrates this in his famous description of the quarrel between the belly and the other organs in man. Provided all these sub-entities, these sub-functions, perform them efficiently, that is, in conformity with the good of the whole, then the man is said to be healthy, just as the state is healthy when its sub-entities cooperate according to their degrees. To refer again to that speech on degree in Troilus and Cressida, how could communities, degrees in schools and brotherhoods in cities, peaceful commerce from dividable shores, the primogenitive and the due of birth, prerogative of age, crowns, scepters, laurels, but by degree stand in authentic place? Logical enough, for no man yet has managed to formulate a state where each part is precisely equal in degree. But lest we suppose this degree structure to be fixed forever in rigid death, Shakespeare assumes it to be dynamic and capable of change. Degree may be taken away, and disaster follows. The universe is likened to a tuned string. If it is slackened, it loses its ability to sing out its own harmonics, or partials, each of which is a degree along the length of the string. So it is with the state and with man. When the parts are in harmonic relation, there is a readiness, a tuned awareness in the being. But when the string is slackened, the tonic, that stretched state, is lost, and an unmusical chaos results. Listen to how Shakespeare describes the ordered state through the Archbishop of Canterbury in Henry V. Therefore doth heaven divide the state of man in diverse functions, setting endeavor in continual motion, to which is fixed as an aim or butt, obedience. For so work the honeybees, creatures that by a rule in nature teach the act of order to a peopled kingdom. They have a king and officers of sorts, where some like magistrates correct at home, others like merchants venture their trade abroad, others like soldiers armed in their stings make boot upon the summer's velvet buds, which pillage they with merry march bring home to the tent royal of their emperor, who, busied in his majesty, surveys the singing masons building roofs of gold, the civil citizens kneading up the honey, the poor mechanic porters crowding in their heavy burdens at his narrow gate, the sad-eyed justice with his surly hum delivering o'er to executors pale the lazy yawning drone. I this infer, that many things, having full reference to one consent, may work contrariously, as many arrows loosed several ways fly to one mark, as many ways meet in one town, as many streams meet in one salt sea, as many lines close in the dial's center, so many a thousand actions once afoot end in one purpose and be all well born. In Shakespeare's order of things, man stands in the middle between God and the devil, or between divine order and devilish rebellion. These opposites meet in man, and he contains the seeds of both. According to his heavenly nature, he comprehends the great plan of the universe and obeys its laws. According to his corrupted or fallen nature, he partakes in the disordered rebellion of the world of time. The bard continually shows that because he stands in two opposing worlds, man is at every turn presented with the necessity of choice. In a given situation, he can act according to his higher, spiritual self, or according to his lower appetites. Every play of Shakespeare contains this choice, and is the story of its effect on the individual, the nation, and so on. When in Julius Caesar the conspirators are plotting Caesar's murder, a terrible storm arises to signify the chaotic violence which follows the destruction of authority and hierarchy. As Casca says, either there is a civil strife in heaven, or else the world, too saucy with the gods, incenses them to send destruction. That destruction is the destructuring of degree and order. The killing of Caesar is like knocking out the keystone of an arch. The whole structure falls with it. Because what is in the state is also in man, the conspirators do to themselves what they do to Rome. We see as the play goes on how the internal unity of each man comes down in chaos, and they are all involved in the ruin they had initiated with the murder of Caesar. And only when they are ruined is order restored by Octavius, the only one of them in full control of himself, and therefore of the external situation too. There's a similar process in Macbeth. Before the lust for power overcomes him, the Thane of Glamis is a most worthy man and an excellent servant of the king. Again, when he contemplates the destruction of authority in the person of Duncan, a terrible storm arises, threatening the chaos to come. And when the king is murdered, day, the symbol of light and order, gives way to night, the symbol of dark chaos. Because he has initiated this process, Macbeth is overtaken by the dark powers of his fallen self, and his light is put out. Some critics have accused Shakespeare of too much concern with order, too much like a propagandist for the Tudor government. But this man was no bourgeois conformist. He was living in dangerous times, when the dogmatic repression of the Middle Ages had finally given way to a new spirit of endeavor, fired by the reassertion of man as an individual being, made in the image of God and with all potentials within him. The Reformation had acted like yeast in the social system, and the ferment threatened every established power therein. Shakespeare had to balance his head very carefully to keep it in its accustomed place, for he knew the power of his genius very well. Drama was a potent instrument in Elizabethan England, and none wielded it more cunningly than Shakespeare. Now, if he'd placed too much stress on individual free will, the plays would have fostered the breakdown of all order. But he knew that the hierarchy of power must remain in being. Though man was blossoming into new freedoms, there were still three realms of law, cosmic, political, and personal, and they must be obeyed. But this dramatist showed that man wasn't bound and fixed immutably in one place or in one degree within that law. The merchant still revered the social order, but he must be shown the possibility of climbing up within it. The villain knew that there must always be masters and laws, but at least he could be shown a choice of masters. The bard was in the van of man striving to know himself. Indeed, in many ways, he still is. He gloried in man's ability to grow by prodigal effort into greater understanding of the universe and his place within it. To measure, to rule, to scale the heights and depths of the creation was man's proper function. For was he not the measure of all things, being the middle or the mediator between God and devil, and containing both? And there was a careful differentiation to be made between the deliberate destruction of an outmoded law, only to replace it with a more comprehensive one, and the destruction of a law only to let riot and misrule hold sway. Jack Cade, in Henry VI, is set before us as a warning of this latter. Reading, writing, government, and all would drown in lust under the misrule of characters like Jack Cade. So Shakespeare shows that only constructive change can develop the full potential of man. And when he does give way to his baser instinct, there is a divine fiat which decrees a restatement of the principle of order. Thus, in all the tragedies, there is a final scene where degree is restored, and the promise of a new life based on the lessons learned through the intervening strife. We're never left in any doubt that man will continue to fall into the dark world, but equally, we're assured that he, or his sons, will profit by his fall and gain a new light. In this sense, the tragic hero in Shakespeare is a scapegoat. He manifests to man his sins and their result, and he saves man from having to commit them again in individual act. The Macbeth, Othello, Lear, and Timon of Athens that dwell in every man exhaust themselves in contemplation of their larger representation on the stage and subside within the microcosmic auditor. One more example of the best and worst in man and his prodigal efforts to comprehend them both is Prince Hal. In Henry IV, the king bemoans the lack of self-rule in his roistering son.
Most subject is the fattest soil to weeds. And he, the noble image of my youth, is overspread with them. Therefore my grief stretches beyond the hour of death. The blood weeps from my heart when I do shape in forms imaginary the unguided days and rotten times that you shall look upon when I am sleeping with my ancestors. For when his headstrong riot hath no curb, when rage and hot blood are his counselors, when means and lavish manners meet together, oh, with what wings shall his affections fly towards fronting peril and opposed decay.
But the Earl of Warwick puts his finger shrewdly on the point. The prince but studies his companions, like a strange tongue, wherein to gain the language, 'tis needful that the most immodest word be looked upon and learned, which once attained, your highness knows, comes to no further use but to be known and hated. So, like gross terms, the prince will in the perfectness of time cast off his followers, and their memory shall as a pattern or a measure live, by which his grace shall meet the lives of others, turning past evils to advantages. Self-rule, and rule of others, is impossible unless a man knows the darker side of himself and others, which could unseat his sovereign will. In this sense, Falstaff and his companions in misrule are as much internal to the prince as external in the world. They are the appetites that he must express before he can conquer, just as they are also the citizens that he must understand before he one day comes to rule them as king. When, as the new Henry V, he imprisons Falstaff, he is also locking up within himself the Lord of Riot, and, like the sun, dispersing the clouds that did cover up his real authority. Throughout the life of Henry IV, Hal's prodigal endeavor to understand all sides of his father's kingdom bears fruit when he himself ascends the throne. This is why the Archbishop of Canterbury says of the new monarch at the beginning of Henry V, "Consideration like an angel came and whipped the offending Adam out of him." The angel there is the symbol of the divine, and Adam is the fallen or animal nature in man. "Leaving his body a paradise to envelop and contain celestial spirits." The body is the battleground of the opposing forces of good and evil, order and chaos, heaven and hell. In it, they fight for the soul of man. Which army he decides to join is his problem at every moment of his life. Shakespeare's preoccupation is with the dual nature of man as the ground of his understanding. Standing in two worlds and partaking of the nature of both, he has the faculty of choice which makes him unique in creation. It's because of this, and because of the infinite potentiality of man, that Shakespeare makes him the center of the cosmic drama. We enjoy and study the plays of the Bard of Avon after 400 years, precisely because of their insight into man, the microcosm of the macrocosm. Shakespeare and the Crown. A good way of ascertaining the value of a given theory or idea is to remove it from its context and note the result on what's left. If one does this with the theory of the crown in Shakespeare, one destroys the whole fabric of the historical plays. And if rule and authority are, as they must be, included under the crown, then all the other plays collapse with the histories. But for our present study, let's confine ourselves to kings. It's long been accepted by critics that Shakespeare agreed with the doctrine of the divine right of kings. Certainly in his own time it was politically important for Queen Elizabeth to foster such a doctrine. Excommunicated by Rome, her subjects released from their allegiance by the same decree, she stood alone against the might of France and Spain. Her country's forces needed a strong central figure to preserve them in a united Protestant state. What higher power could she call upon than the divine to uphold her throne? But Shakespeare's vision wasn't blinkered by political expediency. From the histories there emerges a much more complex view. Richard II might defend his position with these uncompromising words: "We are amazed, and thus long have we stood to watch the fearful bending of thy knee, because we thought ourselves thy lawful king. And if we be, how dare thy joints forget to pay their awful duty to our presence? If we be not, show us the hand of God that hath dismissed us from our stewardship. For well we know, no hand of blood or bone can gripe the sacred handle of our scepter, unless he do profane, steal, or usurp. And though you think that all, as you have done,
have torn their souls by turning them from us, and we are barren and bereft of friends. Yet know, my master, God omnipotent is mustering in his clouds on our behalf armies of pestilence, and they shall strike your children yet unborn and unbegot, that lift your vassal hands against my head and threat the glory of my precious crown.
Brave words. But two speeches later, Richard is submitting to the existential power of Henry Bolingbroke. In the speech just quoted is the vital word crown, and therein lies the subtlety of Shakespeare's argument. The crown and the throne are God-given, certainly. They are the divine emblems of rule which can be granted only by the supreme ruler, the source of all power. As such, these emblems are as long established as man himself. The throne is always firm, in whatever guise it is presented, because a throne is a center or focus of power. Wherever a place is affirmed or a locale is established, there, in effect, is a throne. The father at the head of his table is on a throne, supported by the combined powers of his family. The king's throne is supported by all the powers of his kingdom. The crown, symbol of royalty, originated from the corona of the sun. The sun, of course, is the representative in the physical world of divine power. Therefore, the solar crown was the symbol of benevolent energy and enlightening order radiating out to encompass all lesser powers and orbs. Thus far, Shakespeare doesn't quarrel with the divine right as expressed by King Richard. The need for authority and rule over those who are incapable of ruling themselves is universal. To deny it is to invite chaos. Therefore, throne and crown are in themselves immutable. But he who assumes them had better have the power to carry out the function they represent. And Richard shows us only too well that he has not such power in him, as he says to Bolingbroke, "Well you deserve, they well deserve to have, that know the strongest and surest way to get." In that statement, Shakespeare tells us that despite what Richard may say to the contrary, Bolingbroke is, in that time and place, the hand of God. For he is that efficient executive power which must move in when authority is lacking in a situation. If significant life is to continue and develop, the universal order must be maintained. Richard's moving description of the divinity of his office is like a gorgeous garment with no body to fill it out. Now, Bolingbroke has the will and the ability to fulfill the office. That's effectively his divine right. Where there is a need, it must be fulfilled. Just as in time of war, a nation's need is often fulfilled by dismissing her peacetime blimp and appointing an energetic commander. So, in these circumstances, Bolingbroke is technically correct when he says, "In God's name, I ascend the regal throne." So here we have the playwright saying to his own and other monarchs, the symbols of authority and power are immutable and can never pass away. But he who wears them must prove worthy of the office. Power must be embodied. If it is not, the symbol will be assumed by one who will so embody it. What are the attributes of kingly power? Shakespeare speaks them through many mouths. Mercy, for instance, through the mouth of Portia. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the heart of kings, and earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. Or Malcolm in Macbeth, the king becoming graces as justice, verity, temperance, bounty, perseverance, mercy, lowliness, devotion,
patience, courage, fortitude. The Duchess of Gloucester. Say pardon, King. Let pity teach thee how. The word is short, but not so short as sweet. No word like pardon for a king's mouth so meet. The king is he who knows himself, and knows therefore all his realm. For man makes his society in his own image, in the image of his own being. Such is the bard's belief, and his logic is hard to refute. The king, he says, is like a massy wheel fixed on the summit of the highest mount, to whose huge spokes 10,000 lesser things are mortised and adjoined. This is a variation on the sun theme, and in each image we have the meaning of interdependence. The rim of the wheel is the peopled kingdom which depends on the hub to keep it in orderly, cyclic motion. The hub is kept in its place by the peripheral support of the people. The reciprocal relationship is expressed in the radiating spokes. But above all other symbols of royalty, the sun stands supreme. No wonder kings took it for a badge and reminder of their office. For it's the generating power of nature which gives out its ordering energy to every being on earth. It's the life of the visible world, the creator and the servant of all. The servant of all. Aye, there's the rub. There's a terrible responsibility in authority. It's one thing for the would-be king to say with Richard Crookback, "Do but think how sweet a thing it is to wear a crown, within whose circuit is Elysium and all that poets feign of bliss and joy." But it's quite another thing to feel the weight of the crown and the ambush of the throne. Shakespeare has shown us the divine nature of rule, but he also tells us that the crown doth hedge a king. It imprisons him. Divine right bestows authority on the king, but it imposes its own burden too. The king must maintain. His arm must continuously be stretched out over his realm to govern and protect. His subjects are also his keepers. Anyone who assumes public office knows how irksome it can be to be at the people's beck and call. There's something of this in Henry V when the king muses on ceremony. Ceremony, he says, is the idol built to perpetuate the throne and to clothe the man with more than man. All the rituals which play out for the populace the meaning of majesty to their proper awe are empty nothings to the one who knows the bare facts of power. There is no easy luxury or glory in his place for the man who lies awake and grapples with the problems of his state. The essential quality of power is that it cannot by its very nature be still. Only the slave, out at the periphery of power, enjoys the peace that lack of power alone can give. But the assumption of power also assumes the will to be an instrument of that power. The monarch is used as well as using. In all the histories, Shakespeare details the danger of becoming the central focus of all eyes, the power hub of the state. Dangerous because, should his powers falter, the focus of all eyes becomes the target of their rage. Henry IV, whose great ability self-elected him to Richard's throne, learned this bitter fact. As the lesser powers of the Percys locked horns with his authority, Henry must have felt very much like the bull who takes over the herd from a weakling and glories in his conquering power, only to find in every year that he has to defend himself against younger and stronger bulls until age weakens him and he's driven out to die alone. The king who is not powerful enough to fabricate the intellectual, feeling, and substantial means to maintain his right, and the king who is tricked into identification with outward pomp, alike they do not wear the crown for long. And even those few who remain true to themselves, and therefore to their throne, are racked by the loneliness, the lack of heart's ease, the continuous corruption of body and soul that use of power must always bring. The aging Henry IV, worn out with rule, the weary center of those conflicts which the crown must arbitrate,
says all this in one great speech. How many thousands of my poorest subjects are at this hour asleep? Oh, sleep. Oh, gentle sleep. Nature's soft nurse. How have I frighted thee that thou no more wilt weigh my eyelids down and steep my senses in forgetfulness? It is the cry his son will echo in Henry V. The powerless many can sleep, while the powerful few must pay the price in watchful guardianship. Yet no man willingly gives up power when once he has it. So, at the end of his speech, King Henry wearily concludes, "Then, happy lo, lie down. Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown." The king finally can trust no counsel but his own. For as he is the fountainhead of all initiating action, so also is he the focus of the reaction attendant upon his initiative. Ironically, the controller is most inhibited by the need for self-control. The king is imprisoned by the watchful eyes that take his every movement for a signal. King John says of this, "It is the curse of kings to be attended by slaves that take their humor for a warrant to break into the bloody house of life, and on the winking of authority to understand a law, to know the meaning of dangerous majesty, when perchance it frowns more upon humor than advised respect." Of course, John in that instance was covering his own tracks, but as a general rule it holds true. Men will interpret a careless gesture of the king with disastrous consequences. Dangerous majesty, indeed. Why then, when the crown is so dangerous, when the body, mind, and soul of kings is bent, sickened, and corrupted, why do they seek it? Why do they seek this power? Well, Shakespeare's answer lies in the great speech on degree from Troilus. Then everything includes itself in power. That is to say that power underlies all created things. All degree, all law, all order, control, hierarchy are founded in and kept in being by the will to do so. And the will is power directed and mobilized towards an object. The heavenly order of the planets, the governments of states, and the self-government of the king's own person, each is kept in being by the central authority of the will. As man is made in the image of God, his will is to create, like God. Wherever he goes, in whatever rank, man is driven to act towards some goal. If his will fails, or he turns away from what he's created, then that object collapses. The man of power cannot do nothing. He must strive to express his power through intellect, emotions, and action. The world is the effect of a continuous act of will, and if the will of the Creator were withdrawn from it, the cloud-capped towers and gorgeous palaces would vanish.